So-called free trade agreements are the latest and most serious obstacles to economic democracy. They are a conscious effort to lessen the ability of any political process to impact the creation and distribution of wealth. Ironically, they are using the political process to achieve this. On December 6th, Congress will vote on fast-track trade authority for the president, which will strip Congress of most of its role in shaping international trade agreements, thereby removing even that inadequate venue for democratic input. Fast Track will give the president dictatorial powers under the guise of expediency. The only expediency being referred to is the ability of transnational corporations to exploit labor, extract resources, and make huge profits with little to no interference from those of us whose lives are affected by their activities. The House GOP leadership has decided that it's now or never for a vote on Fast Track. While they still do not have the votes lined up yet to pass it, they hope that by putting it on the calendar, it will enable them to use pressure to force members to vote it in. Meanwhile, having set a date will push the corporate lobby that wants its passage to intensify its efforts. And the Bush administration has also said they would become more involved in advocating on its behalf once a date was set. Citizens seeking to stop Fast Track are being asked to apply counterpressure to their members of Congress in the following ways. Call your member of Congress and express your opposition to Fast Track. Ask for the Chief of Staff, Legislative Director, or the Trade Aide. Demand to know the representative's position on H.R. 3005, coming for a vote this Thursday, December 6th. That's H.R. 3005. There are two toll-free numbers you can call to contact your member of Congress. They are 1-800-393-1082, courtesy of the AFL-CIO, or 888-832-4246, courtesy of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The two numbers, 800-393-1082, or 888-832-4246. Thank members who commit against Fast Track and ask for their commitment in writing to be sent to you immediately. Slam members who are in favor of Fast Track and tell them you'll remember in November. Provide information along with a dose of political persuasion to those who are undecided. Also, visit any town hall meetings or other public events that your representative is organizing and ask questions about Fast Track. Also, try arranging a meeting directly with your member or just drop by the district office. For more information on Fast Track, visit the Food First website at www.foodfirst.org and search for Fast Track. The site has a wealth of information related to food and development policy.
Living in the wasteland of the free. We got preachers dealing in politics and diamond mines. And their speech is growing increasingly unkind. And they say they are Christ's disciples. They don't look like Jesus to me. And it feels like I am living in the wasteland. Got politicians running races on corporate cash. Now don't tell me they don't turn around and kiss them people's ass. You may call me old-fashioned, that don't fit my picture of a true democracy. And it feels like I am living in the wasteland. We got CEOs making 200 times the workers' pay. But they'll fight like hell against raising the minimum wage. If you don't
Kensington Welfare Rights Union was formed in Philadelphia to address the issues of poverty and homelessness and is one of the leading grassroots organizations advancing the issue of economic human rights in the United States. The KWRU is notable because its members and leaders are themselves homeless, formerly homeless people, and others who come from the ranks of this society's poorest and therefore most despised groups. Sherry Honkala is the director of the KWRU and one of its founders. She spoke last month in Ithaca.
I want to start off by telling you a little story that I usually begin any talk with when I talk about how the Kensington Welfare Rights Union came to use human rights language and begin to approach our work from a human rights perspective. It's a little unorthodox. A little different than sitting in a classroom and somebody passing out the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and telling us that these were the rights that we have and that we should do something to reclaim these rights. It was actually in 1995 in which the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, if you don't know anything about our organization, we, when homeless families are in need of some place to live, we either move them into abandoned houses or we build encampments, and they sometimes turn into towns. And this particular encampment or town, we always think that somebody's responsible for the development of these shanty towns, so we make sure that we give these shanty towns names. And this particular shanty town we called Ridgeville, after our governor. because after all, he was responsible for the population of people in the town. And so people would come up to American Street and it would say, "Welcome to Ridgeville." And we would have homeless families living in shacks, and we'd use plastic, and if we were lucky, we would have some wood, and we would do whatever we possibly could in order that the families could stay together, they could stay alive. And one day, we got a horrible message, which is two portable toilets showed up with a little note from the mayor saying, "I hope that these toilets will be of assistance to you." So to us, it was kind of like saying, you know, get ready to live like this forever and expand your town and we'll provide you with toilets. And so we decided out of necessity that we had to begin to go someplace else and to do something different. So from that encampment, we decided to march for 7 days. We marched to Harrisburg to meet with our governor and to ask him, what would we do with all of these homeless families? And when we got to Harrisburg, after marching for about 22 miles each and every day, we didn't know that you had to put Vaseline on your feet. We didn't know anything about long marches. We just got up every day and marched until we basically dropped in the evening and slept alongside the roadside with our children. When we arrived at the governor's mansion, he didn't even send out the janitor. And so we lined up, remembering the history of Senator Roxanne Jones, who was the first welfare recipient to run for state senator in Pennsylvania, who at one time had been furious with the governor, and she had taken off her shoes in the middle of a debate and hurled her shoes at the governor. We decided to pass on her legacy. And so all of us, all the homeless people, lined up in front of the governor's mansion, took off our shoes, and hurled them onto the governor's lawn. Needless to say, this was not a good idea after marching for 7 days, to be left with your blisters now on the roadside with all of our shoes laying on the lawn. But we decided then that the homeless families needed some place to go. This was not just a demonstration. This was not symbolic. So we took all of the homeless families and we moved ourselves into the Capitol Rotunda. And while we were in the Capitol Rotunda, we got to know the janitorial staff. We got to understand how politics work. And the first day that we were there, they were having a bipartisan event of champagne and caviar, and they arrived in ballroom gowns in the rotunda. And the head of the Democratic Party stepped to us and said, "Could you go down to the end of the hallway and I'll give you some free box lunches?" And one of the homeless women said it the best, which is, "We didn't walk for 7 days to talk about being homeless in Pennsylvania to be hidden down at the end of the hallway for a free box lunch." Needless to say, that evening they had the shortest event I think they've ever had in their life, with us sitting on the stairs, them in their gowns and with their champagne and caviar. They quickly decided to go home. But we remained there on the floor in the rotunda for about 6 weeks. And it was very exciting to the homeless families to have things like running water, to be able to use a toilet, to have the experience of heat in the evening, and to be able to have lights, to be able to see your way around in the evening. And so while we were there, we were also engaged in other kinds of activities that happen in our capital, which is they decided to have, a couple people decided to get married in the rotunda. And so we got the leftover food from the weddings, and we got the bouquets, and the brides wished us well. Janitorial staff began to bring in their children saying, "This is what real homeless people look like." We'd wave. People began taking little field trips to look at the specimen of homeless people inside this building. And then one day came where they began to post notices around the entire Capitol stating that this public building now had a closing time. And so one day, when we didn't expect it, the entire state troopers in Pennsylvania filled the rotunda and literally picked us up and threw us out onto the front stairs. And while we were out on the front stairs, we decided that we had to stay. We had no place else to go. So we took big pieces of plastic and created a huge encampment on the Capitol stairs. And this time, the homeless people that they wanted to make invisible, the governor now approached the Capitol in the morning to a sign that said, "There by the grace of God go I, welcome to Ridgeville." And so people from all over Pennsylvania could see us on the Capitol stairs. And every day that we were there, we began to gather support from different people throughout Pennsylvania. And then the day came when they threatened that tomorrow at noon that they would evict the homeless families from the Capitol stairs after we had been there for another 6 weeks through the rain and the cold weather and you name it, but we still hung in with each other. And on that day, we decided that we would ask community legal services for assistance because, after all, we had First Amendment rights. We had a right to demonstrate on public stairs. Certainly, if they could throw us out of a public building, we had a right to be on public stairs. And when homeless people, the last thing that they have is their voice, certainly that can't be taken away. And then that horrible morning came when the head of legal services came and spoke to me on the Capitol stairs saying, "Sherry, I'm terribly sorry, but we've been threatened by the governor to take $1 million from our budget. We're not going to be able to represent you in order to keep you on the Capitol stairs." So we decided to organize a tour of the governor's mansion at the same time that we were expected to be evicted from the Capitol stairs. And then we returned after our wonderful tour, and the mother spoke out about what it was like to see that the governor's dogs lived better than their children. And that night on the Capitol stairs, the coldest night in October, at about 2 o'clock in the morning, the governor ordered the removal of the blankets. State troopers came and took blankets from men, women, and children on the coldest night in October. And it was that night that we had to walk. We walked to the end of the grocery store, and we got plastic from Sheetz Grocery Store and cardboard, and we wrapped ourselves in cardboard and plastic and continued to take shifts in walking all night so that nobody would die from hypothermia. That's how the Kensington Welfare Rights Union came to understand human rights, what it felt like to be considered less than a human being. That's how we came to use the language of economic human rights. I'm so happy that all of you could be here tonight and take time out of your very busy schedules to let me share some of my thoughts with you about the dire situation that we find ourselves in as a nation. And I'm not referring to Afghanistan or anthrax. I'm talking about the emergency situation of absolute poverty of our poor, that they are barely enduring and barely surviving. I'm talking about poverty in the United States of America, in the land of plenty. Let me begin by talking about our children, the thing that we say as a country is our most important and precious thing in our society. 1 in 2 of our children will never complete a single year at Cornell or at any other college across our country. 1 in 3 will be a year or more behind in school, and 1 in 4 will be born poor. 1 in 5 is poor right now, and 1 in 5 will be born to a mother who will never have had prenatal care. 1 in 7 will live with a parent who works but still is poor, regardless of them working full time. 1 in 11 lives at less than half of the poverty level, and 1 in 132 will die before the age of 1 this year. And in 1 in 680 will be killed before they reach the age of 20 by being shot to death by a handgun. Yet every 14 hours, we will spend more on the military than we do annually on programs for children. Every 29 hours, we will spend more on the military than we do annually on a summer jobs program for our unemployed youth. While millions in today's America are deprived of their basic human right to food, to housing, health care, and a living wage job, the U.S. infant mortality rate continues to soar, and so do poverty rates and illiteracy rates. They are amongst the world's worst for an industrialized nation. We will watch as the number of millionaires continues to triple, while the ranks of the homeless are doubling and the looming crisis of millions of more are about to line our streets next year, as we dismantle our only safety net that we've had in our country. As women and children begin to hit their five-year lifetime limit on public assistance, and they are cut from the rolls forever. Some estimate that more American children die each month because of poverty than the total United States combat deaths in the entire Vietnam War. Yet many of us continue to wallow in illusions of opportunity, that somehow we will make it, somehow we will be different, and somehow we can sit this one out, that we have no responsibility to the next generation. But American children are counting on you, are counting on the students here at Cornell, and so are we, the poor in this country. Because we know that we can no longer fight this fight alone. We know that there has been an undeclared war, and we will not win it without your assistance. This movement needs you now more than ever to use your power and, yes, your privilege as students to help in the building of a massive movement for economic human rights. We need you to document the stories of those who aren't surviving this undeclared war. We need you to hold teach-ins on this very campus about what's really happening in our country. We need you to hold marches and rallies and speak-outs and give voices to those of us who are being made invisible or are being made to absolutely disappear through the prisons, the drugs, and to death because we don't have these basic rights. And as we begin to watch the faces of the poor, as we see them over and over again, of the poor in Afghanistan, let us think of the faces of the poor that you will never see on television at home. And as you cringe in the fear of encountering anthrax, or cry for the 13 people who have died from exposure, cry too for the thousands who have been exposed to heroin and crack cocaine and didn't have a right to recovery or mental health care and have died as a result. Yes, we understand the problem of being a part of an invisible war in which no humanitarian packets are being made for our fighters here at home, who are struggling for their survival. We understand the importance of making this war at home visible to the entire world. So that is why we are organizing a march on opening day of the Winter Olympics in Utah. We will wear green scarves to show our growing unity with the poor around the world, and most importantly, with the largest poor people's movement in India, the peasant farmers. We will also continue to house families by moving them into government abandoned properties or by building other Ridgevilles or building other encampments in the shadows of mansions. And as we struggle to keep our people alive by doing food distributions and engaging them in the fight for their very survival as we teach them how to fight, Let us ask the question tonight, what will you do? We know that what we are doing, those of us that have been pushed to the edge and what we will do, the question is, what will you do? What will you do for the American children, America's next generation? The future of our country collectively resides in your hands. Now it's up to you to help us decide what kind of society all of us will live in. We're doing our part. Will you do yours? Thank you. Now I'd like to call up four people that are doing their part every single day. Galen Tyler, Sarah, Charles, and Jasenia. Come up here. And we'd like to open this up to a discussion. These are folks that don't get paid, that every single day of their life work around the clock trying to build this movement.
When asked what the Kensington Welfare Rights Union has accomplished in the last 4 years...
We've been able to do a lot in the last 4 years. People tap onto our website from every single corner of the world. We literally have thousands of people that consider themselves as a part of this movement. We've got about 80 speaking engagements on a monthly basis from all different kinds of members of the organization that are speaking all around the country and in different parts of the world. We held a Poor People's Summit in which we linked together poor people's movements from 32 different parts of the world. We've kept a large base of people alive and developed hundreds of leaders across the country that are actively involved in dedicating their whole life and building this movement. So a lot has changed in 4 years, mostly the economic situation that we find ourselves in, which is a recession, jobs that are leaving forever, and a dismantling of a welfare system, and a safety net that ends this next year.
When asked how each got involved with the KWRU and why they stayed with it...
Hi, my name is Galen Tyler. I'm chair of the local organizing committee with the Kensington Welfare Rights Union. The way I got involved with the Kensington Welfare Rights Union in 1997, I became homeless, me and my family, and we was living in Virginia at the time, in Chester, Virginia, a little outside of Richmond. And my family moved back to Philadelphia. And I stayed around trying to find a job and stuff like that. Wasn't successful, and I got like 2 months behind on my mortgage. So I also moved to Philadelphia. And I stayed with a family member who told me about the Kensington Welfare Rights Union and how they fight for affordable housing. And so I went to like a food distribution, a couple of clothing distributions, and started going to different educationals based around the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and how people organize to take what they need. And that's how I got involved. The reason why I stay with it, man, it's pretty simple. I used to be homeless. I'm no longer homeless. But as long as like these conditions remain in this country and in this world, an individual could die from a preventable disease, become homeless, or not get a nutritious meal on a daily basis. I see that possibility that could happen to me again, as well as my kids and, you know, my grandkids. I'm looking into the future. If we can change it so that this condition doesn't exist, then, you know, if everybody had their basic necessities, that would include me and my family as well. That's why I stay.
Hello, my name is Jasenia Cruz. I'm a 22-year-old mother of two boys, age 5 and 2. About a year ago, I became homeless. I was cut off of welfare, lost my apartment, and I started sleeping in my car with my children. Because of that, I lost my children, and sorry.
I apologize for your tears. Okay.
Because of it, I lost my children, and I lost my car, so I had no other place to go. So I found out about the organization because it was located right behind my grandparents' house. And I seen the sign and decided to go in and ask how they could help me on getting a house so that I could get my children back. 2 days later, They put me in a takeover house. I was able to get my kids back. And right after they put me in the house, we did like sit-ins. We did sit-ins in City Hall, City Council Chamber, the Convention Center. We did sit-ins in a church. And the 26th of this month will be a year since I've been with Kensington Welfare Rights Union. And the reason why I stayed is because they gave my life. They gave me my life back, which is my children.
Sir Charles.
Hi, my name is Charles Tyler, and I'm originally from Virginia, and how I heard about the Kensington Welfare Rights Union is through my brother. He called me, told me that he wanted me to come stay in Philly with him, so I did, and from then on, he took me to his organization, and then I seen what his work was, and at first, I didn't want to do it, but then after a while, I seen that all the families were coming in with their problems. It changed my mind, and I wanted to help them.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I work with the Kensington Welfare Rights Union. I've been there since I graduated from college about 2.5 years ago. And I graduated from college knowing that I was going to move to Philadelphia and work for the Kensington Welfare Rights Union. And that was because of a few different things. One is that when I grew up in a pretty wealthy suburb and I went to a really fancy school, and then I had done some alternative spring breaks with the Kensington Welfare Rights Union and just began to see how clear it was that some people had everything and some people had nothing. And that really hit home for me. I went to school in North Carolina to Duke University, and I imagine it's a lot like it is here at Cornell, where there's a lot of people who want to make sure they're on the side that has everything, not the side that has nothing. But for me, that wasn't really going to work because my dad went to a private university and ended up unemployed when I was growing up. And so I realized that going to college wasn't necessarily going to guarantee me to be on the everything side. And so what the Kensington Welfare Rights Union taught me during my alternative spring break was that no one needs to be on the nothing side, especially in a nation like the United States where there's so much. And so I decided to work for the Kensington Welfare Rights Union because, like Galen was saying, everyone should have a right to food and clothing and housing, and that's what I want for my family, and that's what I want for my friends. And we can all have it. And if people aren't getting it, that means that it's possible for it to be taken away from me too. So that's why I stick around. Thanks.
When asked what work Kensington Welfare Rights does with policymakers,
we fight things in the courts, the streets, and in the legislature. You know, I'd lie to you if I said that we weren't involved in developing policy on a local and a national level, from congressional members calling us to us having congressional breakfasts in Washington, D.C. with different important muckety-mucks to important meetings that we have at our capital in Harrisburg. So, I mean, currently right now we're engaged in, they're going to spend X amount of billions of dollars right now in Philadelphia. We've got a wonderful mayor, Mayor Street. He was highlighted from our wonderful President Bush, our governor, you know, the guy in charge of Homeland Security. You know, our chief of police? Okay, I know. He came from New York. It's pretty scary people there. But so, yes, we're involved right now in a fight to take some of the billions of dollars that are going to be spent on demolition of the 27,000 abandoned houses in Philadelphia because there's a blight problem. We're hoping that $1.95 of that blight money will go towards the development of affordable housing. Right now, however, there's not one city council member that is interested in using any of that money for affordable housing. Our mayor, it ran on an anti-blight. You know, blight is like
you know, the graffiti, the abandoned cars, the abandoned houses, trash, loads of trash. And if you just clean it all up, right, it's going to bring back the economy and revitalize the neighborhood and bring everybody that has participated in suburban flight back to the city. If you just do this major cleanup job. And of course, that's not what's happening. We're turning into, you know, what's happening across the country, like in Detroit. You know, you just have fields of abandoned land that used to be houses in which people that used to live in those houses used to work at General Motors. But now you have really nice land, or in Philadelphia, we're trying to set up gardens in each of these abandoned property lots. So you too can have a garden in a former refinery site in Kensington.
When asked whether the housing takeovers were effective...
We're problematic for the blight plan right now, because if you have 27,000 abandoned houses, 23,000 homeless people, and the Kids to Welfare Rights Union's busy moving the homeless people into these abandoned houses, it kind of gets away in the way of your blight plan. So it's pretty hard to demolish properties if human beings are living in them. So it's been very effective. I mean, what can I say? They're great. I mean, it's great to have a house, and particularly like in the Midwest, in different parts of the country, they keep the heat on throughout the wintertime because they don't want the pipes to freeze and break. And so you have heated abandoned houses that somebody was thrown out of because they were foreclosed upon and the government takes possession of, and then they pay a realtor, they contract with a realtor to ensure that the property remains vacant. It's a hell of a plan, isn't it?
When asked, what would economic justice look like?
You know, I think as the situation gets worse, this is going to be a harder conversation. Because I'd like to just suggest, you know, to go up to a particular section on our website where we suggest various different policy changes or our different elected officials that we can talk to change these various different things. You know, of course, we're advocating universal health care, affordable housing, living wage jobs, all of these kinds of things. But first, we think that, you know, next year is right around the corner. And millions of people are going to lose their only way of feeding, clothing, or housing themselves. And something is going to happen. There's just no way that you can take millions of people and cut them off of the rolls in the same year and have nothing happen. On March 3rd, that very day, just in Philadelphia, 8,000 people in Philly are going to be cut off of their only way to feed, clothe, and house themselves. This is on top of a 10-year waiting list for affordable housing and a freeze on even being able to apply for emergency housing, where you can't apply anymore. So, yes, of course we have a vision of what a new, you know, a different kind of world would look like. People would be employed. We'd make use of people's skills. We'd create the kinds, there's plenty of jobs that could be created, all of these kinds of things. But right now, we're trying to figure out how do we keep these people alive so that all of us can engage in this upcoming fight that we're going to have to, out of necessity, be a part of. Because starving to death and freezing to death on the streets of America is just really not up for negotiations.
When asked why KWRU has chosen to march at the Winter Olympics in Utah...
Our invisibility is incredibly dangerous. And that's why we are marching on opening day of the Republican, Freudian slip. We did that too, of the Winter Olympics. You know, because there's going to be the 1,500 reporters there from around the world. And we think that the American people are just beautiful people. They just don't see what's happening to people. And we think that that's the fundamental problem. If they really saw what was happening to people, we as a people in this country, we wouldn't tolerate it for another minute. And so that really is the problem. is we've got to start, you know, organizing reality tours. Hell, have everybody from Cornell for a day charter buses and go visit, you know, a soup kitchen or go interview some homeless people or go talk to a factory that's about ready to lay off everybody. Those are the ways that people really begin to, you know, I mean, it's the human factor. Decide that they need to get involved because people begin to have faces instead of numbers.
When asked who will be participating in the march at the Olympics,
we're all going with you and your 2,000 other friends in your family's car or bus. We're linking up with everybody, from unions to plumbers to doctors, lawyers, janitors, filmmakers, dentists, police officers. If they want to march with us, that's fine. I had a detective the other day that said, you know, you guys continue to keep up your work. I had another officer tell me the other, you know, a few weeks ago or whatever, he's retiring. He survived Vietnam, but he's not going to work in North Philadelphia once the welfare cuts go into effect, because he's not going to risk his life trying to keep hungry people away from the local grocery store.
When asked about applying for public grant money for community development in Kensington,
what they do in Kensington is like pretty much what they do all over the place, which is have a group of people fighting for various different crumbs. In particular, most of the social services or after-school programs or those kinds of things are pretty much aligned with the Democratic Party. There's a lot of politics involved in what you would think is just an after-school program. And it's very interesting because pretty much from the after-school program to the who gets a swimming pool in what neighborhood to all of those kinds of things have to do with alignments and whether or not you're considered to be a team player. So if you have, I can't speak for other community groups or whatever, but KWRU hasn't really ever been seen as a team player, which is kind of problematic because most of the services that are provided for poor folks come from the Democrats. And they're, how do you say the word, patronage jobs? Yeah. See, and we don't have any problems with demonstrating in front of, you know, Sister Mary Scullion's Project Home because homeless people are being denied shelter. And she happens to be aligned with the mayor all the way up to President Bush. Well, I guess that's Republican and Democrat. There's really not much difference. So, yes, that's the problem. So, no. I used to think that you put in proposals and then based on whether or not you had a good plan, you were funded. And then I realized it's really about who you know and who you're connected to and who you're aligned with. And you're even in a better situation if you're connected not only to that politician, but if you're connected to that politician's corporation that funds his reelection. And in Philadelphia, most of the HMOs pretty much determine whether or not you're going to get a swimming pool in the neighborhood, whether or not you're going to get whatever. Because most of the community groups and that kind of stuff, they pass around these little grants. And then that kind of, it's an unwritten agreement that you're not going to demonstrate against HMOs, even if there's somebody in your organization that's being denied, you know, a heart operation from that HMO. You're not going to demonstrate against them because your organization gets money to run an after-school program. You should follow the money, figure out who gets the money. There's a really large foundation in this country. I won't say the name of the foundation. But if you look at very large foundations in this country and you look at their annual report and who they funded, the more abstract the organization and you've like never heard of it in your life and the more that they do absolutely nothing, the larger their funding is. It's just incredible. You don't believe me? Go look yourself tonight.
When asked whether KWRU worked on the needs for childcare and healthcare,
while we protest against things, we also set up our own cooperative way to deal with things like childcare and feeding each other and housing each other and all of these kinds of things. But actually, this coming summer, probably on May 1st, we're organizing national sit-ins in hospitals across the country simultaneously on May 1st. With people in as many cities and parts of the country as possible that have desperate healthcare problems that they're not getting addressed. So May 1st is going to be a nationwide sit-in in hospitals demanding healthcare, particularly for real sick people across the country that can't get access, and it's life and death healthcare questions.
When asked what other marches or protests are being planned,
in November next year, we're going to go around the entire country and collect the stories again. We're doing our second nationwide bus tour to document what has happened, what will have happened to people next year as a result of being cut off of public assistance. So that's a nationwide freedom bus tour, freedom from unemployment, hunger, and homelessness next November. And then the following year, we're in discussion around another month-long march to the United Nations.
When asked how the KWRU sustains itself financially,
thank God for the person in the middle of Idaho that sends us money every week because she thinks we're doing, which I think too, we're doing the Lord's work. And so she stopped putting it in the plate on Sundays and now sends it to us. And we literally have hundreds of people like that across the entire country that, you know, send us their stories and send us the few dollars that they got because they're very inspired and have been given some sense of hope and see themselves as being able to connect to what's happening and that they have a contribution to make. And that's, you know, the little bit of resources that they have to contribute. You know, it's really the resources thing. It's fascinating how we've been able to deal with the money thing. And thank God America has credit cards. At any given time, we're about $50,000 in debt. And so it's always cute when somebody says, you know, I'd like to donate a couple hundred dollars. Could you put it towards, what was it?
The bus.
Can you put it towards the bus? You know, so that stuff is, you know, it's wonderful. They just really don't understand we're already starting with a $50,000 deficit. And so, like, when we put $200 towards something, it kind of goes to the air. So we're very creative. Thank God we live in America because, you know, plenty of houses. So there's houses, plenty of surplus food. I think anybody that's got a vehicle that has a life expectancy of a month gets donated to us. And so we really only got to worry about gas. We have very supportive people that know how to turn on the electric and the gas and work for those companies. The water department. And so for a while we borrow things like water and electric and heat until a family's able to, you know, individually pay for those things. And we've had to make some very hard decisions. You know? Hard decisions. You know what I mean? Like, you know, the nice car. We've learned to deal with each of us individually too, right? We drive a vehicle that has the life expectancy of a month. We live with whoever we have to live with. The keeping alive of the movement for some of our really developed leaders even means at some point perhaps giving up the house that they live in because they have the ability to move into a campsite and live in an encampment because we may need the $600 or whatever that is called a human rights house that the four or five people are living in. We might need that $600 for something else that's far more important at that given time. So we're constantly, each of us, having to challenge our own selves around the issue of commitment. You know, we grew up in America. We like nice things.
We didn't take an oath to poverty. None of us want to live like this. There's nothing romantic about it. I would much rather be like traveling the world, going vacationing, hanging out with my son, going to movies, and, you know, doing a lot of other really fun things like that too. And I'm going to at some point, as soon as we change all of this.
That was Sherry Honkala of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union in Philadelphia. For more information, you can visit their website at www.kwru.org.
Down and Out in Ithaca by Glynis Hart. It's a line you cross quietly from the borders of being broke into a country where nobody knows you. Oh, sure, they know you. Your friends know you. Your family knows you. What they don't know, because you don't want to tell them, is you're stone flat broke. So broke, food is a problem. So broke, you feel kind of panicky and pissed off because it should be obvious you're cold, you're homeless, you're hungry. Maybe you're living on your friend's couch. Maybe you just got here and don't know anybody. Or maybe your rent is paid, you've got a car that works and is legal. Your clothes are fine, you just don't have any money. Ithaca's not a bad place to be broke, at least when it's warm out. The town is swarming with social workers, which is a disadvantage. In fact, if you go down to the commons around lunchtime and listen to the suits, you may notice its principal growth industry happens to be social work. Because at this point, the social workers outnumber their clients 3-1. If you get involved with social services, expect constant scrutiny and supervision. It's virtually impossible, for instance, to hold a job while collecting food stamps or welfare, because you will be required to visit your social worker constantly, at random appointments set by her, him, to resubmit papers you've already submitted, and to undergo a gauntlet of humiliating procedures like fingerprinting and alcohol testing, designed to weed out those bad people who are faking being poor. Don't let it get to you. Think of all the social workers you're keeping employed. Admire their shiny big building, the fleet of nice cars they get to take home at the end of the day. On business use only, of course. Lots of social workers started out right where you are. This is what's called the system when it works. They don't get paid much, so the only way a social worker can really get by is to marry one of the lawyers, our number two growth industry. And if that wasn't enough weight on the old conscience, they have to cope with the fact that after all those appointments and all that document checking, the social services don't give you enough to live on, which gets us back to nowhere land, the land of no money. About food. There are a number of food giveaways. If you have a car, most of the outlying towns, such as Danby and Enfield, have food giveaways scheduled one day a week. Here you'll usually find things the grocery stores donate. Lots of bread. Bread, rolls, cake, and more bread. Produce. Pick through it if you're allowed. There's nothing like standing in line for an hour, signing your name as one of the official poor, and suffering the sanctimonious pity of some of the giveaway volunteers, only to find, when you're home, you got yourself 2 bags of stale bread and rotten vegetables. In town, there are several food giveaways, the most stable being the one on Tuesdays behind the Catholic Church. The Salvation Army is another long-timer. Ask around. Churches and other places get in on the act pretty regularly, and the Church of Christ holds regular clothing giveaways, which can be a godsend if you've got kids. Generally, what you won't find being given away is protein. If you're going to survive being broke, you need to feed your brain. Canned beans and rice, if nothing else. Or if you eat meat, you can get a pound of ground turkey at Aldi on Route 13 for less than $1, or a dozen eggs. You might find peanut butter at the food giveaways, but that's probably the closest thing to a protein entree available. The local soup kitchen, Loaves and Fishes, operates out of St. John's Episcopal on Cayuga Street. The hours are on a sign outside. They have lunch Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and dinner on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Most meals have a meat entree and a vegetarian alternative. You can volunteer pretty easily if you want to work off your meal or if you need something to do with the time on your hands. Sometimes there will be somebody playing the piano or the guitar. The atmosphere at dinner when somebody's playing music in the background and people are chatting can be pretty nice. I know of people who aren't broke, going just for the company. Personally, I recommend avoiding the place like the plague on Christmas and Thanksgiving. Ordinarily, the volunteer crews at LNF are pretty nice people. Really nice people. They're not looking down on you. On the holidays, however, suddenly hundreds of citizens get the call to serve their fellow man by volunteering at the soup kitchen. If you feel like it, on Thanksgiving, you can have your own personal waiter. Some of Ithaca's most prominent citizens will be serving up your turkey dinner, sporting shit-eating grins of benevolence. They really feel good about themselves, but never mind. As soon as the holiday's over, they'll be gone. Washing. Big problem. When you don't really have your own place, you don't really have your own shower, sink, etc. If you're somewhat local and you know the swimming holes, you can get by swimming at the reservoir or businessman's lunch, go up Giles Street during the summer. You may feel a little self-conscious taking out your shampoo and toothbrush, however. You can walk or take the bus out to Buttermilk Park. There's a $5 parking fee if you have a car, and use the showers there, or go to Treeman, which is a bit farther. The showers at Treeman are pretty reliably hot, but they have only one setting. The marina out past Cass Park has showers you can adjust, and there's no parking fee. The wealthy people who moor their sailboats at the marina also use these showers. Be cool, be polite, and they'll be polite too. Their slip fees are high, and some of them consider that makes it their exclusive shower, but it's really publicly funded. You're paying for it too. And it's a nice walk to get there, unlike sucking gas fumes all the way out 13. In the winter, the park's closed down. You're stuck, but fortunately you've got lots of clothes on, so it's not as obvious if you're smelly. If you have friends in college or some student ID, you can use their gym showers. Being really broke is a depressing, energy-draining experience. You may feel too depressed to do anything. Fight this. You've got a whole culture around you telling you without money you're less than dirt. So arm yourself with the great thinkers who were poor, too. Turns out to be just about anybody worth a damn. Read the Bible. Read the Dhammapada. Spinoza. Read Charles Bukowski. George Orwell. They'll cheer you up. Knut Hamsun. Gorky. Good company. Okay? Survive.
That was Down and Out in Ithaca by Glynis Hart, an article published in the most recent edition of The Cobbler.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. The rich will